Thundergrunt.
It's time for a new episode of Writer's Blockbusters. Episode Woo! 4, I believe.
Episode 4.
Wow. A new I'm Bob Rose, and with me is Jimmy George.
Hello.
And Jamie Nash.
Howdy.
And today we're going to talk about the sequel to a beloved, to my heart, like deep within my soul, man. A beloved classic, Jumanji. We're going to talk about Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, which is actually Jumanji 3.
Right.
But we're, you know, people, I've been calling it Jumanji, but.
Is a Thora Jumanji connection? I mean, I know it was a sequel.
Other than it just being similar and based on a book by Chris Van
Pretty sure I saw a box set with it in there.
Really?
Yeah.
I think it's. I also think Zathora is a phenomenal movie.
I love it.
Oh, yeah. I love Zathora, like, a lot.
Me too.
But this is technically Jumanji 2. Really? Well,
yeah,
that's...
Did you hear they already greenlit the sequel to this, and they're calling it Jumanji 2, which makes no sense to me.
What?
Yeah,
really?
They did. Mm-hmm.
They should call it Jumanji.
They should make Zathora the video game.
That's a good idea.
Either way, we're going to talk about Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, the Jake Kazan-directed movie from 2018. That's still in theaters right now. This is probably, as far as movies we discussed, the most current movie.
Yeah.
This is still like actively, people are still actively going to see this.
Strangely, it's on demand and still in theaters.
I actually saw it 4 or 5 weeks ahead of time because I bought those Adam tickets.
When did you see it?
They had a promotion through Amazon with Adam, ATOM, where you could buy tickets to a super advanced screening. It was like an experimental. So I saw it like months in advance.
Yeah. Didn't it come out against Star Wars?
Yeah, well, here's the thing. This is the interesting thing is, and this is why it's still in theaters and on demand. It is, I think, the third or fourth highest rated or moneymaker of last year. And I think it's like third or second internationally.
Yeah.
It made $400 million last year.
Wait, last year?
Yeah, it counts
opened
on last year.
2017, it opened in December.
Right. Did it open?
Yeah, it opened against Star Wars. Dude.
Was it that long ago?
Dude.
Gosh.
So here are the numbers just to give you. Star Wars Last Jedi made $600 million. And change. Beauty and the Beast, $500 million and change. Wonder Woman, $412 million and change.
This is domestic or global?
Domestic.
Okay.
Jumanji made close to $400 million. It'll probably eke right around $400 million. And as far as international goes, it's close to $1 billion.
Yeah, it's like $900 million plus.
Yeah.
For this.
This for movie. This.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's a blockbuster and worthy of talking.
As
about
it says
on
our on our line here. That's why we're talking about.
Yes,
that's why we're talking about.
Because people like this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, I did. I thought I was never going to be sold. The trailer was quite horrendous.
I remember posting when you posted the trailer. Okay, I'll bite.
I know. I had to convince Jimmy not to hate it right off the bat.
I actually like the trailer.
Really?
Yeah, for some reason.
Yeah.
My wife loves it. She was like, I'll see that.
Right, right. Well, I mean, what reason is there to hate it? You know?
No,
the
no.
Rock. Who doesn't love The Rock? Is there a human on this planet that doesn't like The Rock? I don't want to meet
Stone
him.
Cold Steve
he
Austin.
Austin. Right. He's sitting at home like, well, I like Zathora better.
The people's elbow, man.
Yeah, right, right. So the first thing we're going to talk about is that it was written by four guys.
Four guys. Probably more, but...
yeah, I know. It's true. Yeah.
I thought it was worthwhile just looking at the credits to talk about this briefly.
Yeah.
But if you look at the credits... It has, and I'm doing this kind of from memory, it's story by Chris McKenna. Well, it's also based on the book by...
Chris Van Allsburg.
So it's story by Chris McKenna, written by Chris McKenna, ampersand Eric Summers, and Jake Kasdan, ampersand... Hey, I missed somebody here. I'm sorry. Jake Kasdan and Scott Rosenberg and Jeff Pinker. That's wrong. That's actually from the script we read.
Oh, wow.
Cut Jake Kasdan off.
So he's not credited on that.
He's not credited. We took a look at like one of the earlier drafts, yeah. The last drafts of the script, and Jake Kasdan's name was on it, but he didn't get credit.
That's so interesting.
So anyway, Chris McKenna and Eric Summers, first of all, just to kind of unravel this mystery, Chris McKenna and Eric Summers, I think they're the Spider-Man guys.
Spider-Man Homecoming and Lego Batman.
Okay, and Lego Batman. Oh.
Two movies I love.
Yeah, I love both of them.
Yeah, they're great.
So strangely, only Chris McKenna gets story by, which suggests that even though Chris McKenna and Eric Summers are writing team, Chris McKenna must have been on the project before in some ways, or pitched the treatment or done something like that. When you see an ampersand in movie credits, that means a writing team. And if you don't see an ampersand, if it's just like the next slide or the next list, then it means somebody rewrote the other people. So Scott Rosenberg and his partner, Jeff Pinker, came in and rewrote the Chris McKenna and Eric Summers draft. And to get on there, this is the thing, you need to rewrite at least 33% of the movie. Okay. That's the rule.
I didn't know.
I love that it's 33.
33.
It's 50 if it's an original, but because it's a sequel or an adaptation, it's only 33.
Oh.
And the thing that always fascinated me about this is that Rogue One, if you ever look at Rogue One and you unravel the credits of that, you'll see that the people that came in after the movie were shot got credits. But one of the people that were on the movie the whole time, I think it was Gary Whitta, at least until it was finished, until it was shot, he only got story by.
Oh.
So it tells you how much that movie must have been rewritten in post.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Okay. That a whole bunch of people that came on after the movie was shot and were only there for the reshoots actually got credit
for
screenplay.
Feels like it, but that's another discussion.
Yeah. We're not doing a Rogue One podcast. I've done that, actually.
Yeah, I know you
I
have.
I had plenty to say.
I didn't know those designations, like the 33% on a sequel.
Yeah, and
or
so
remake or
how
reboot.
It actually works is if all the writers get together and kind of collude and just say we're not going to go to arbitration, you can basically make a deal with each other.
Okay.
Making a deal is the wrong word. You can just agree that you all put your names on there. But anytime it goes to arbitration, those rules kick in.
Okay.
So a bunch of your peers, it's like a jury from the WGA, have to read all the drafts and they have to decide who gets what credit and stuff like that. It's a thankless job. I've never had to do it. I've been in arbitration before. I've actually had my scripts arbitrated, but I've never had to actually arbitrate a script, which seems like a nightmare.
Yeah, I bet.
Jesus.
You have to read like 10 drafts or something. And like in this case, we
movie magic, everyone.
Yeah. In this case, we have, you know, all these writers, but we don't even know. There could have been a punch up.
Yeah.
Jake Kasdan could have done
I'm
the final
sure
drafts.
He did more.
There has to be some improv in there too to boot.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
All of that stuff. Maybe there were reshoots for all I know.
Yeah.
But yeah, this movie, $90 million budget.
Budget.
Yeah.
Wow.
Made close to $1 billion so far.
Man.
There you go.
I mean, you can't argue with that.
I know.
I'm actually just still reeling from Jumanji 2. That angers me to no end.
Yeah, it's listed at least right now as Jumanji 2.
It might be a temp title.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Which makes no sense. Yeah.
Well, what do you guys think works so well about this or is connecting so well? Why don't they make more movies like this anymore? They kind of family genre movies.
I think you brought up off the mic, the cynicism aspect that's not in this, you know.
Yeah, my first review after I saw it all those months early was how this is not for cynics. If you're going to go in cynical, it's not going to work.
I think the squeaky clean, the days of the squeaky clean, like monster trucks.
Yeah.
Used to be what was always in the movies, you know, go ahead.
I didn't watch Monster Trucks. I wanted to,
it's
though.
It's on Amazon Prime.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I still watch it.
I haven't either.
You know, this is almost kind of the scripts I've dabbled with in the past. Like, I almost wish these movies.
This seems
like
it's up your alley, Jamie, honestly.
On the far side of this, like Galaxy Quest or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, that's really what I'd love to
do. That's like
a
masterpiece of this genre. Yeah.
Even Men in Black to an extent.
Yeah.
Same. Yeah.
So I have my theories on this because I've tried to peddle these scripts and they're not as interesting. I think a lot of the actors went away. I think you had Robin Williams and Eddie Murphy and Tim Allen.
The custodians of this genre. The
Yeah.
big names of comedy acting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think there just aren't any, like, who do you put in this besides The Rock? I mean, The Rock's the last one. He was in, like, the Tooth Fairy.
This, I mean, this movie has, I would say The Rock or, I mean, Jack Black.
Jack Black I feels Black, like
he's
that.
He's still solidly that. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. He's amazing in Goosebumps. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. So they're the two that are left. They're, like, the last two guys standing, or the new two guys, or whatever you want to say.
If you take out, like, the Will Ferrell crew and all them.
Yeah.
Maybe. Who haven't really done those kind of movies.
They kind of stopped.
Sandler dabbled. He did, like, Click and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even Vin Diesel did a little bit. He had a few
kids movies.
That's
right. He did The Pacifier.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But then also, I think, so that's part of it. But I think the other part of it is Pixar rose up. And Marvel rose up as the movie's families go to together. Mm. If you have a younger family, it's probably Pixar. If you have an older
family,
you'd
probably
just
say Disney, honestly.
Disney. Yeah, Disney.
Marvel. Yeah.
Disney decided MCU, that this was, these movies were going to be the movies they made instead of the old.
Yeah. I think they just took over that whole space. And that's
Listen to the tone in all of our voices over that one. Not that I don't love
the
that
magic
stuff,
is gone, man.
Right.
It's the wonder.
So you don't get these as often. I mean, I can't. What was the last big one that hit like this? I can't even think of
that. Hit like that actually connected?
Yeah, like maybe not made $1 billion, but made
a blockbuster of this nature.
$100 million.
My, like, everything you just said, my mind is clouded up with Marvel.
If you take out Marvel and Pixar, what do you have? I don't know, man. Yeah.
My mind went to Kingsman,
that
but that's too adult.
Yeah, too adult.
But that has like the spirit. But if you added an R rating,
even comedies are hard. If I ask that question, like, is it Horrible Bosses? Is it, you know, what is the last
what
one?
Is,
that,
yeah,
you know, like if it's this kind of R rated.
The
comedy.
Industry's so different now. I don't. Yeah. Yeah. I guess this is kind of a rarity. Then
it is a rarity. Yeah.
Yeah. For this,
it's
comedy,
a sequel,
action,
but
family movie,
or hopefully everybody will be like, "Well, we need the next Jumanji."
Yeah, what
jungle.
Is it? Yes,
they tried to do that kind of with The Rock and Journey to the Center of the Earth and all that stuff.
They
but
it's a good point.
The Brendan Fraser Mummy movies were
kind of
in this.
They
vein,
were kind of,
but
they were, but they were more marketed
gone.
To adults.
They were probably more like Marvel.
Yeah,
what Marvel is, they were scary. They had real stakes, danger, but the whole family could go watch them.
It's light enough that it's not like
I saw this in a theater full of kids.
Did they like it?
Yeah, they were loving it. They were laughing really hard. Yeah,
so
especially at
Kevin
Hart. So this
is filling a hole that's been absent for a couple years, if not for 10. And
it's at least half the price of those other movies, at least.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's not 3D.
Which is really surprising.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the script, though.
Okay.
I feel like we got the money part of it, but...
let's talk about the script.
No, this is... Yeah, let's talk about mixing genres.
Okay.
Yeah,
because
like, the original, I would say, is not an overt comedy.
No, not at all.
It's actually quite a heartfelt kids movie. Robin Williams is in it, but he's not the goofy line spouting Robin Williams in that movie.
No.
And it's fine. I don't want that movie to be different. You know, it's a heartfelt family comedy. This is like...
So this is... What's interesting to me is this is... I think this is marketed as an action adventure movie, as a kid's action, or, you know, a kid friendly action adventure movie. But it's really, if you watch it, it's a body switch movie, like Big and Freaky Friday. I mean, all the big major beats of the story are based around their body switch. And
it's funny because it's two different types of movies. So there's the whole Blake Snyder genres thing where he talks about out of the bottle stories.
Yeah.
And there's two different types of those. There's the curse one, and there's the out of the bottle. And in this one, because it's a four-hander, you have four lead characters.
Explain what a four-hander is.
Four lead characters.
Oh, okay.
It's just really... really
I'm just for people listening.
Yeah, no.
Bizarrely, they call everything two-handers, and even if it has four people, sometimes, like old-school books call them two-handers.
Yeah,
it's
weird.
So anyway, it has four leads. But those four leads each occupy, like... you know, almost different. One's a curse, one's wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
The other's a curse, the other's wish fulfillment. So you have like two wish fulfillments and two curses.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both. It's the best of both worlds as far as those movies go.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Smart. That's why I was kind of insulting the trailer beforehand, because I don't feel like it conveys a single one of these actually really smart concepts like the thing you just said.
No, not at
all. It does. The marketing did not convey that this movie actually kind of had really...
But it worked.
It worked. I can't argue with it.
Look at all the money it's making.
Yeah. But I also think word of mouth has a lot to do with that money.
Yeah.
It's still going strong after all these months.
It's true.
Before I got here, I rewatched the trailer just out of curiosity. And it spends a minute and a half describing what happens.
You know, right.
Because it needs to describe who each of the characters becomes.
Yeah.
And it's funny, the two different trailers both do it different ways. And then the last half of the trailer is just pure action.
Action.
To Welcome to the Jungle.
Yeah.
Welcome to the jungle.
Exactly. Well, the title kind of dictates that, right? For anyone that, should we, in case no one's seen it, should we give a little rundown of what the movie is? Just
if you haven't seen it, don't
listen to this. Why are you listening
to this?
I guess.
No. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So what I find interesting about the handling of genre in this movie is it made me think about, you know, what defines the genre, and for me, it's what the goal is. And so if it were an action adventure, their goal, yes, is to get that jewel and put it back in the eye. But really, the reward is their bodies, right? All of this is leading. Yes, there's like stakes of survival. They make it primal. But ultimately, what they're trying to do is get back in their bodies. So for me, that's why.
Getting back home.
It's their bodies, like their physical self.
Oh, okay.
And at the very end, Braverman, Spencer doesn't want to leave. He wants to stay in the body. You know, he's like. That's like what's holding him back. He's like, I have this body. I don't want to go back into my other body where the other. So for me, since they are ultimately trying to get back to their bodies, then like it's a body switch movie.
Yeah.
I agree, but I also kind of agree. It reminded me of also like Wizard of Oz. Like
that's true.
It's not to me. It wasn't just about
just
the bodies.
Cut and dry. Yeah.
It was like getting home.
Yeah.
Because in the end, the jungle's not their home. That's just about who they are as their physicality. It reminded me of Wizard of Oz. Like at the very end with the goodbye with the PC character.
Yeah.
The UPC character and everything.
I think they even made a joke, didn't he? I'll miss you most of all.
They did make a joke.
The movie had that like weird quality of like, why is this making me think of Wizard of Oz? Yeah, like
it was a nod. Yeah. What do you think defines the genre in a story?
Defines the genre?
Yeah, that makes you go, okay, that's what this is.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about the story?
Where would you put this in a video store shelf?
Yeah, that's
what shelf, Jamie?
Bob, I love that question. You asked that question
because
I lived it
for years.
Where
so.
Would you put this?
Family film.
Family. Yeah. Okay.
It's
which is
lame.
A really mushy like shelf.
Problem is it's going to be sitting next to like Babe and you know Charlotte's Web animated, and I don't know that it probably has.
I would go comedy on this.
Comedy.
Yeah, it's a comedy.
I think this is more defined as a comedy.
Just
directly.
Straight comedy. Yeah,
you're probably right, and I almost think family's too limiting for it.
Yeah,
you know, like not the right people will be able to see it. Also, like Goosebumps kind of was like that too. Like that recent Goosebumps movie. I think Goosebumps is closer aimed to family than this. This is probably
I would put that on the family shelf.
Yeah.
We're always assuming that these are all VHS tapes on this old this store shelf that no one uses
What's
anymore.
What's a VHS tape?
Right, exactly.
Oh, God.
But I can see where you're. Goosebumps to me, at least, I think that would be, I could put like little kids in front of a TV and they could probably enjoy it. This seems almost like it's just bordering on a Kevin Hart comedy.
Well, it has dick jokes, I think.
It does.
A lot of dick
jokes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's how this works.
You're right. Yeah.
The other thing I'd say about it, too, like when we look at the trailer, and this is why I looked at the trailer, I was looking at the trailer to see what the trailer moments it brought. And the trailer moments purely, if you look at the trailer, the trailer moments are purely action adventure.
Mm-hmm.
They don't necessarily highlight what's unique about the concept, because essentially all the action scenes in this movie we've seen done better in other movies like that. The only thing that adds to it is that instead of The Rock being confident, he's not.
He's a scared kid.
He's in another person's body.
And the Kevin Hart character is actually a frustrated guy that would be confident.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's all those things. Jack Black is, you know, the
selfie girl.
Yeah. So that's the thing, that you can have all the regular action scenes, but that's what makes the action scenes unique to the movie. And the trailer doesn't really have that. It's just like rhinos chasing a helicopter
I really feel like this movie, particularly with the marketing, after walking out of the movie, I said, this movie is wholly uninterested in actual action.
Yeah,
it's a comedy. I walked out and I felt like this was basically people talking. It most like the actual scenes, like when, like you said, when The Rock is for the first time beating people up, it's a scared kid pushing buttons on a controller, and he's actually like dictating it. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
most of the antagonism is internal, like between them,
right?
All just arguing with each other.
Well, in a field, most of the time, they're just in a field.
So, let's talk about. Well, let's talk about the arcs first.
Okay. Yeah, arc.
Yeah, go ahead. I like your two-handed, four-handed.
Oh yeah. Well, the one thing I was going to say, when you have a movie like this with four characters, it becomes really hard to set up the arcs, or even set up the characters. So each one of the characters gets one like obligatory moment to say, this is who I am and my problem. And it's very on the nose. It's very obvious. And it has to be, because the writers have to be economical.
Clear.
They don't have any time. Yeah.
You have like, what, five scenes before they get sucked into the computer world or game world?
Yeah. And usually when you're constructing your setup, you're showing all the things that need fixing in the character's world, their home life, their work life, their relationships.
In the main character.
But this one, it's like, okay, we got these four people. Let's show one thing.
It's a commercial.
Thing.
It's like, I can't cut a tomato. Exactly. If only I had a sharp knife. Right. Well, Jumanji has sharp knives. Yeah, right.
And that's all you can do. I think one of the things they do that you see this a lot, they try to introduce all the other characters through the main character. They try to.
They use Spencer as the...
I don't think... What's the girl, the selfie girl's name?
Bethany.
I think she might get some outside the POV
scenes, does.
But all the rest of them are pretty much through Spencer.
Through Spencer, yep. Even that scene with Bethany where she sees him at the house, it's sort of through Spencer.
I think that's her second scene.
Yeah, I think you're right. Because she's... When we meet her, she's... taking a 5-minute selfie.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, what Normal. Better way to define an entire character?
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, her perfect. Moving that coffee cup and everything is perfect. Yeah. I was like, okay, I don't need anything else.
That's, you know.
She's like a mean girl.
Yeah.
And then there's such a great payoff when she's like, the blinking contest. Like, this is what I do. I assume that was a payoff to the, that's the right. I read it, yeah. to the selfie. But yeah, they just give them that one thing. They're basically more archetypes, tropes.
Mm-hmm.
You got the jock. You got the scared kid. You got the self-absorbed girl. You got the smart girl. And that's all you got. And then you're going to get to the next scene.
It works. And I would agree. You were saying this. It's very serviceable.
Serviceable.
And that's what... That's the only thing that's really kind of like...
But you know what?
This.
I feel like they also were self-aware in that they were batting low here. Like, you know, like, no one's going to give us anything. So we don't... Like, they met... the expectation
of what
I had of a Jumanji sequel in 2017.
They're not, they're not talking down to the audience or the characters or anything like that.
No.
They're not devaluing what they're showing us, but they're making it simple, clear.
It wasn't disrespectful, sloppy.
No, there's nothing complicated
like,
about it.
Yeah.
It's very easy.
Yeah.
Easily digestible.
And because on top of setting the characters up, you also have to set up their situation. So they each have to get detention.
Yeah.
They each have to, you have to relate how the characters feel about one another.
Yeah.
So all these things have to happen and you have like 12 minutes.
Yes.
And that's all you got.
And they do a really good job with it. Yeah. The setup is very, very,
if I had one thing to compliment this movie on is that I felt the through line of the actual characters through the whole movie.
Mm, definitely. Yeah.
Like, you know, those kids, the kids that I saw that 12 minute beginning, I feel like they stay with me through the whole movie.
Yeah.
After seeing it twice.
And by the end, they are doing things that they wouldn't have done in the beginning. Yeah, all of them.
Each of them, as is typical with these body switch movies, learns a lesson.
Yes.
Yeah.
Comes out the other side.
Yeah. One of the things I like about it is it's sort of got that, I feel like this is missing in a lot of contemporary stuff. It's got that, I mean, Marvel does it because they have so many characters that they have to please the audience who are like fans of these comics for years. But that Gene Roddenberry, instead of like one hero doing everything, everyone has to work together and use their strengths to get the goal, to reach the goal.
I don't know how, I don't want to jump too far ahead, but that is pretty much because of the kind of ingenious concept this whole thing is based on, right? It's a video game.
It's a gamification.
Right. In a video game, you need to all work together to win.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And yeah, so the characters all have to work together to get this, you know, the
MacGuffin. But I think I feel like I don't see in enough movies, you know, that like it's not just one hero and then you have all the window characters who make the hero better. It's that you have four heroes. And all of them.
Yeah, the movie doesn't belong to any one of those people.
Pirates of the Caribbean, I always thought, did a really good job
with that. But I agree with that.
They would nudge people forward in each movie. Like, this might be...
Center stage. This person is a little... Like, Spencer's the lead.
Spencer's nudged forward. But all of them get their full stories.
Yeah.
Just as far as arc and themes go, what did you think, you know, what are those 1 second arcs that we have?
So for setups, you know, Bethany's is pretty, we talked about it. Bethany is a selfie and she, and they do a great job of making the goal visual, right?
The vapidity, but it's beyond.
And it's, she actually, they actually show you like with the lives on the wrist, she gives him her life. We get to see it go away and then being given to him, like they make the goal visual, so she literally sacrifices her life to save another. So I mean, what better way to arc the selfish character?
Like her story ends at that moment, not when she gets back home.
That's it for her. And then they have, so we were talking about how on the surface Fridge seems pretty, he seems like the least developed character, but I do think that he has an arc, and I think it's about using his intelligence and not trusting in himself. Would you say the theme is like self-actualization, like trusting?
Well, yes, because the principal literally says it at the beginning. He says, "Who you got to decide who you are."
Yeah,
and that's the movie right
there. It's the old theme stated on the nose.
Minute seven.
But I feel like the movie recognizes it.
Well, minute seven.
In the end, Fridge actually repeats it and says, "What am I doing?" You know, they kind of wink at
who
you.
Who are you?
Yeah, no, the movie's like definitely self-actualized. It knows what it's doing.
Yeah, it's
winking.
For Fridge, he does get that moment. When we meet him, he's a guy who's not trusting his smarts and like literally paying his friend or making his friend do the brain work for him.
Because he always got by on his muscles.
Yeah.
So then
he is the guy who makes the plan. Like he is like, here's what we're gonna do. So he's the brains of the operation in the end that gets them to achieve the goal. And like, so he gets that. And then with Spencer, it's pretty simple with Spencer. I feel like Spencer has two, and that's like brave and strong. Mm-hmm. You know, like he's
I think it's fear and confidence.
Yeah, his setup is pretty funny. How scary he is! Like, I mean, the mom opens the door and he jumps. it's pretty.
Yeah,
it's a little goofy, but whatever.
It works. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, he literally picks a character named Braverman.
Yeah.
You know? It's really on the nose.
Yeah, yeah. Bravestone. Bravestone.
But then with what is her name? Martha.
Fear.
What is Martha?
I feel it's fear because she's within herself.
They had that whole quote at the end where they said, I'll paraphrase, but it was something like, you know, I get angry at people before they can come at me or something. You know, I hate people before they can like me or something like that. There's some kind of fear that they won't like her.
Okay, so she gives up that.
She pushes people away.
So she lets people in then.
Yeah.
And she opens up.
Yeah, that's her.
And she's opened up by the vapid person.
Right.
Yeah, she is.
Maybe one of the best scenes in the movie, which is when Bethany teaches her how to be sexy.
How
to open herself up. Bethany being Jack Black, by the way.
Clearly written by a dude.
but it still works. Man.
No, it works great.
It's really funny.
It works great. It's really funny.
It's funny, too, that this goes back to the two types of character arcs we talked about once before, remember?
Yeah.
Learning to be more confident or learning to care more.
That every character arc, in case anybody hasn't listened to a previous one.
Our first episode.
Exactly. Either it's being more confident or learning confidence or learning to care more, caring more.
Ever since you said that, it's so true.
I hate how much it works. I don't want to boil it all down that simple, but.
Well, I see a lot of movies. This one has almost one other one that's not really set up as much, but the teamwork, well, you got to work together.
Yeah, working alone.
I find that to be a third one.
Okay.
A lot of times, like when you think of The Incredibles, for example, that's the theme to that.
It's working together.
Lone Ranger.
Yeah, if I had to add a corollary, I bet you teamwork or working together, working with others is easier than being the, you know,
yeah.
There's no I in team.
No I in team.
Yeah. I think that might be the
That's a good one.
I'll add that.
Yeah. That's a third one.
No I in team.
But I think everybody has clear arcs in the movie. You know?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
oh, it's
definitely
blatantly there. I mean, it's a kid's movie. It's not like it's trying to hide it or be like, you know.
I, I always find the best way to learn character arc is to go to kids' movies.
Yeah.
Because they're all there. Pixar movies are great to learn character arcs. They're obvious. They state them. They say what they are exactly. But also movies like this, these kind of movies, they don't make anymore.
Exactly.
They're the perfect movies.
And I think you can learn a lot. Like, they all have their own structures. They all have beginnings, middles, and endings. They all have their dark nights of the soul individually in the moments. You know, like the guy, Alex, is afraid. The helicopter man, like, I can't do it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That was a great... I really liked that scene. Yeah. That character.
I enjoy any theory that involves respecting kids' movies.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
It's still one of my favorite genres because of reasons like that.
I actually believe it's the best one to study for these. If you just want to do breakdowns,
there's
no better way than to just get a bunch of Pixar movies,
Toy Story,
and start analyzing why they work, where they work, how they work.
That's a good transition into something, the sequence approach I was going to touch on later, but I'll touch on it now.
Sure. Go for it.
One thing I really like is when a movie gives characters mini goals to get to the big goal. And kids movies tend to do this a lot. It goes back to the gamification, but I think it was happening before the gamification of cinema. And that is, you know, they have to get the missing piece, right? And then they achieve that goal, but it's not what they thought. It's different.
It's a different
thing.
And
then they have a new goal. And every step along the process, we understand that what the overall goal is to get that jewel back into the eye of the jaguar, but they're given these little visual goals, and each sequence of the movie, each 10 minutes or so, is leading to that one. It's like 8 mini movies. There's a great book called Screenwriting the Sequence Approach. Have you read that one?
Yeah, the mini movie method. Also,
yeah.
Christopher Soth.
That's one, but there's another one by this guy named Paul Joseph Gallino, and it's one of my favorite.
Books,
yeah,
right? they teach it at USC or UCLA.
I went to a seminar of that guy's like 20 years ago.
No, it's great.
Ever since I read that book, I kind of changed the way that I was writing. And like I said, this was like 20 years ago. Mm-hmm.
And basically what it does, it breaks a movie up into 8 pieces.
Yeah.
They're 8, 15.
Yeah. 10 to 12 minutes.
And each one has a goal or a question that kind of gets resolved, leaves a cliffhanger.
But every single one of the questions and the visual goals, we understand that it is leading to the overall goal. Like it's 100% related. Mm-hmm. And so it carries you over. It keeps the quest interesting. Mm-hmm. Instead of just being like, what about this jewel? Like, and talking about the jewel for 80 minutes, you're talking about the missing piece.
Right.
And then this,
It's telling us to go to the market. What do we do at the market? You know,
It makes everything consequential.
The sequence method actually is a really cool way to break a story if you only have like a log line or an idea. Because you can really sit down on a piece of paper and in a day, kind of have a little bit of a story.
Yeah.
It's a great first step.
Absolutely.
In fact, one way I used to do it is I used to make a title for each sequence. You know, like, and that's
so it's a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This wasn't something I really came up with. I can't remember who it was. It's in another book. But they had like, you know, the Yellow Brick Road. So maybe the first one would be like, what would you call the first part? Kansas. Or something, of Wizard of Oz. And the second part might be the tornado.
Chapters.
Something like that. So you're
the DVD chapters.
That's what it is.
It's what it is.
So you come up with 8 DVD chapter titles that are more on the nose and less creative, I guess.
And that's how I write my movies. When I write a screenplay of my own, not like I can be compared to these, but the method that I use is I'll say, okay, sequence A, I'm doing sequence A this week.
Yeah.
You know, and next week I'm doing sequence B. You know, and then when I have 8 of those weeks, you know, I've got a full script.
And it just goes to show that structure. There's lots of different tools you can use. There's no one thing. You know, I always use save the cat term. Some people might use Robert McGee. Some people might use the sequence method. They're all just methods to pull a story out of you.
Yeah.
Or if you don't use any of them and you just type and you're good
do
at
whatever
that,
you just sit down in a typewriter and then 18 hours later have a screenplay. I know people that do that. It amazes me.
Are they good? And they're good.
I mean, I don't know.
A little hesitation, man.
I'm big on outlines. I think.
Me too. Saves you trouble.
I mean, are you guys?
Yeah, I've said yeah. So
that was me.
This movie is a good. If you're looking at it from a screenwriting standpoint, this movie is a great example of how to use mini visual goals. in sequence, building to an overall.
Which is kind of ingenious to the concept again.
Of the gamification. Because it's perfect.
Is that a word that...
I just call it that.
Okay, you're saying that. Okay.
I deal with... Yeah, I read scripts all day. And okay. So I read scripts that are very, like... the
video games.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Okay.
It's an easy term for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, also, like, that whole concept goes back to also... We talked about, like, how they're in their bodies and these new bodies that don't fit their actual personality. But... it's not just that. In the actual game itself, they're all given, like, purpose that they never had. It's
absolutely...
the game is forcing purpose. It's not like they can just back.
No, they can't avoid it.
No.
They have to do it.
He
has to be the
There's
guy.
There's no choice that you are carrying the backpack with the weapons. You have to do this.
Yeah.
And you're slow.
And then there's even the life element. You know, they have these tattoos of bars on their arms that are their lives. And... it almost seems like that's the ticking clock in some ways.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't think about it as a ticking clock. I talked about it. I thought about it as visual stakes, but it is a good ticking clock because, you know,
you can kind of tell as the audience member, okay, they have three lives now. We can have a little bit more fun. We're going to watch them get killed a few times before they get to one and zero.
But sooner or later, they're getting down to
What's
that.
What's the term that you guys always use for like when people play with the new powers? There's a term for it. I've heard you guys say it like 100 times.
Look, now we're not sounding as smart.
I know. Now I just ruined everything. But it's when people like they have fun with like the newfound
the fun and games.
The fun and games.
Fun
section.
And games.
Well, talking about the trailer moments when he was gone.
Right.
Fun and games is the promise of the premise delivery essentially.
No. Well, I'm saying the fun and games could come in when they knew they have a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
They have lives, so they can screw around with this world a little bit.
Well.
The first half's usually going to be a little less stakes, and then the stakes are going to rise. But in this one, it's almost predictable how the stakes are going to rise. They're going to lose their lives, and they're going to be...
But they don't realize it. So I think this movie does a great job of raising the stakes. It's another good study, like one that you can study, easy to understand. First, they're like, whoa, we're in a game in different bodies, and that's scary. But then they're like, whoa, we can die and still be alive. And then they're like, wait...
We
can die three times and we're dead.
It's a little like, you know, two other out of the bottle movies. I guess you'd call them this. You know, one I think of Bruce Almighty. You know, I'm a god.
Yes.
And I can do all these great things.
But it's
and then
caveats.
It's going to change.
Yeah.
And even to an extent, Groundhog Day. You know, I'm a god. I can do.
Yeah.
I can use this stuff as.
I can't even die.
I can't die. I can just party all day and have a great time. And then, of course,
then eternity is a ball and chain that you can never escape.
Yeah. But I think it does a great. I didn't think about the lifelines on their wrists as a ticking clock, but I think that's a really good point.
Also, it's really good at using those ticking clock slashes on their arms as like great character moments, like the fact that Fridge kills Spencer.
And you look,
you know, like, yes, he knows it's not permanent, but still, it's like that moment is like maybe the darkest moment
Absolutely,
in the movie.
Yes,
when he throws him off the cliff, it was just like. Wow, like that moment couldn't happen without that device.
No, you're right.
You know what I mean? Like it was a genius device. It's
smart.
That device having multiple lives, that's one of the things that gives the movie the most uniqueness, I think.
I think
so
too.
You can kill them off many times.
Because you
that's
can.
That's the fun of it.
Yeah.
It's fun to see how.
And I'm glad they didn't like lean on it. They didn't like give them like 20 lives
no,
or something.
No, they gave it. They, kept,
they
yeah.
made it
they
like
made it
manageable.
Like an arcade.
Then it would be like Groundhog. We need a montage of deaths.
It's another movie, but I probably would watch it where all those actors were exploding all the time. It's just a bloodbath.
Maybe the TV series.
There is a great moment though that deals with the lives that one of my favorite moments of handling of stakes is when they know they're gonna die right if they lose all their lives, but then they see this guy that they run into Alex right and they think like we found the missing piece, they're all excited
right,
and then they learn that the reason he's still there, he hasn't tried, is because he only has one life left and he's scared and they haven't reached that one life point yet right, he's like a vision of their future, and then they find out like holy shit, he's been here since 1996.
That's the midpoint stake raiser.
That's
when
like,
things get more serious,
exactly,
they get a little more dangerous,
and they're like we could, if we don't achieve the goal, we could be here forever.
We could lose our lives.
We could be alive. We could be alive, but stuck here forever.
Right.
Yeah, which I don't think they had really faced until that moment.
Well, that was the one thing about it that at the beginning of Act Two, I was almost like, there is no ticking clock here.
Yeah.
So there really was no reason for them to rush into
their journey.
Let's
go. Yeah.
They could take their time if they wanted to. I mean, They did rush into
Well, they were being hunted. They were being hunted. That
Yeah, but they didn't put the foot on the throat with the people hunting them. You know, they took their
time.
No,
it wasn't really well handled, but it was I'm like, just pointing out that it was
happening. No, you're right.
So Van Pelt
that threat
is,
was
is,
there. Yeah, let's talk about Van Pelt.
Yeah, well,
I would love to talk about Van Pelt because it's
go
so
for it.
Because I mean, I think I already said it on Facebook and you read it, but he's not a very good villain.
No, he's a,
he's
shitty,
a shitty
villain.
He's but crappy. The movie being the movie that this movie only because it's supposed to be a 90s PlayStation game, he would be a shit villain. He's shit because he is literally part of the device. Like,
that's a good point.
Like, he is a shit villain. Those villains were always shit. His motivation is power. Oh, no one cares. My only complaint with him, you could keep him exactly the same, is I just want to see less of him.
Yeah.
I don't need to, no, but seriously, I don't think we needed to see his camp and stuff.
Well, that was to me the weirdest part.
Because, yeah, definitely.
Because here's the thing: it's their POV,
yeah,
their
right,
video
right.
game. Why would we see the POV of a non-player character,
right?
Of an NPC
game?
Character?
Didn't make any sense.
That's the only thing I would cut out because he can be shit. It just I don't need to see it.
We don't usually do this in the podcast, but I gotta say, like, I think it would have been cool if the villain would have been a player. Stuck in the
I
game.
Thought that's where they were when I first got there.
I feel
there,
like they should have done that.
I'm gonna disagree because what my dream here would have been, the way that I would have made this.
I don't like talking this way, but whatever.
It's fine. No, but we're talking about Jumanji. I think that what they should have done is they should have got the original actor that played Van Pelt, and he'd be playing an older version of, because this isn't technically all. Just
that would have been good.
And he's more pissed than he ever, because he's been in there and he hates Alan Parrish,
mm-hmm.
and like, so he's like this artifact of the magic of Jumanji, but he's been stuck in the jungle without anything to do for all these years, and he hates players more than anything.
Yeah,
I think that would have added this other dimension to it and also locked it into the original movie.
Yeah, solid connection.
And that actor's not doing anything. Get that guy a fucking check.
Yeah,
you know what
exactly.
I mean? Like, just an older Van Pelt who's like bent on revenge against all players because Alan Parrish is the one who got away.
Well, the cool thing that you just brought up, it's the classic thing to make your villains better, right? You make them not the villain in their own minds.
Exactly, yeah.
This villain, because it was just an NPC character, it was just mustache, twitchy kind of
thing. Yeah.
He was an arch-villain.
He was an arch-villain. He wasn't as interesting as, like, the Wicked Witch or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about Wizard of Oz. Imagine if this did have a Wicked Witch.
I mean, controlling
it.
The bugs and stuff was kind of cool.
It's cool. I think why he works, though, because I think he does work. He's serviceable. We've used that a couple times. But I think this is a beyond a serviceable movie. I really like this movie. I think it, for what it is, it does a great job of it.
Yeah, and I think the conflict of this movie really isn't about the villain. It's about being trapped in a game.
Hence why I'm saying show less of Van Pelt. I just need to know that he was out there coming after them. I don't need to see his camp and him talking and stuff.
So there's a Sid Field thing. It was pretty hilarious. So Sid Field had these things called pinch points in screenplay, his book screenplay. I never really understood what a pinch point was. And one day I looked it up, and it was like in the middle of the fun and games section. So in the middle of the quarter point, between, you know, the break into two and the midpoint, there's one little scene that reminds you of the threat that's going to come at the end. It's just a reminder that they're having fun now. They're doing this stuff. We're just going to remind you right here that there is a threat. There is a problem. And that cutaway shot, as much as I kind of hated that we had the NPC characters POV, it served that purpose.
Absolutely.
It was to remind us that the inevitable was coming.
For me, what worked is because I see a lot of writers who don't do this. And I think for many stories, what makes a good villain is that they want the same thing as the hero. And in this movie, it's very
Raiders,
clear. They're,
like Raiders.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of people don't do that. Mm-hmm. And I think the saving grace of this villain is that they both are after the same thing.
Exact
right?
same thing.
Yeah. So I think that's why it works. I mean, it's simple. He wants
so
the jewel.
You were saying, I thought when you wrote it down in the outline, you were saying it for the same reason I was, but no. Was
no, different. I'm saying it as as a teaching moment. You know, if you're looking to learn from this movie, why he works is his goal is the same as the heroes, which is to get the jewel.
For me, it was just I didn't expect anything from him because he was an NPC character.
Gotcha.
That was my whole thing. I was like, yeah, I don't care, but I shouldn't.
Yeah, like, that's no, that's true. But yeah, all the complications he puts in their way is so that he can prevent them from getting the thing that he wants. And that's, like, very compelling.
And
you
that's, like, the typical way to build conflict, right?
Yeah.
One character wants the same thing as the other person. And so they can't have it, so they're gonna butt heads.
It doesn't really matter who's good and evil; it's just who gets there first.
It sounds simple when you say it out loud, but I see scripts all the time that don't understand simplistic.
The other thing that people suggest maybe you sometimes develop your villain is by basically saying, "What is your character? What do they want?" If your character, your main character, your protagonist, was ruthless and had no morals. That's your villain.
Yeah, the opposing value.
It's the same thing, but with no morals, no debate, no inner conflict.
That's what he is. And he does that. He serves that as well.
He's a good example of that.
Yeah, he is a good example of that.
Snidely Whiplash. Yeah. Right. Right? I mean,
That's absolutely true.
I think we're getting close here, but something we kind of smoothed over was the freak house. We didn't talk about that. Do you think is it related to the overall arc and theme?
Yeah, what do you
at
think?
All? Is it useful?
I think it's useful.
You think it's useful?
I mean, it's a connective fiber into the how we got these people into the game, you know, and then they all are aware of the history of the house, and then they have a new understanding of why it's all scary, but. I don't know, man.
Right. Usually it just struck me as the type of thing you usually tie into the central theme. Like somehow it's related in some way. Whether, you know, let's say it was like the guy couldn't move on with his life until his son was back or, you know, some
story. Oh, the father in the house.
Tim Matheson. Tim Matheson.
Usually a scene like that is a macro version of whatever
of the movie
theme is. So I was trying to connect the dots. Is there anything there? But I don't really see it.
I don't see it either. I think it was more. It doesn't have to have it. But it was a good question. It would have been cooler. Yeah. Wouldn't it have been cool?
It's just a thing to show the loss of the child, right? Yeah. That's all.
Yeah. Well, also like the future of the characters if they don't get out.
The reason you put that in there is that because you're saying that like. That Tim Matheson's dad character should have had something about him, just a one point arc.
I was more wrestling with wondering if he did have something, you know, if there was something to be thought of or something like that.
It kind of throw back to the first movie, how everyone assumed that Alan Parrish's father had murdered him.
Yeah. Right.
And I kind of felt like that was an echo of
that. Yes, yes.
Because all the kids
were
paranoid of this house. He's this crazy old man that lives there.
They think he murdered
his family. I just figured it was kind of like a flashback to that.
But I like
that's
it
what Jumanji
been good if they did
that. That's what Jumanji the game does to people.
Yeah.
It turns them into these like social outcasts because of it's unexplainable disappearances.
They become a local urban legend.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Not for the right reasons, though.
No.
Yeah.
What's the guy's name that's trapped in the game? I keep forgetting.
Which one? Spencer?
Yeah. No, I'm sorry.
The guy at the beginning.
For years.
Yeah. Alex.
Alex. Alex, yeah, yeah.
Is he connected to the theme in any way? Like, does he have any... What lesson did he learn in the movie?
He didn't
give it clear. His
to go back to what I said, he's the Wizard of Oz right there. He just wants to go home.
Yeah, he's Dorothy.
And he's been there way too long.
Yeah, they make that clear,
years.
Too.
Yeah.
It's all about him getting home.
He also has the fear, though, of...
The flying. That's what I was trying to wrestle with that.
But they didn't put it in... When you meet him outside, though, outside the game...
But there's no time for it.
No, there's no time. But I'm just saying, compared to the rest of
them... How would they even...
I know.
He has to find the game, and he's flying a plane, and he lands on the beach. I don't know.
He's in a flight simulator when you meet him.
I realize what you're saying, but I don't feel like that's necessary in the script that he needs to have.
I was just trying to do the math of tying that fear of flying into the rest of it. Because it feels like an art kind of moment.
Absolutely.
It seems like the writer was sitting down and saying, you know, this is some personal thing
he's going to face.
It seems so superficial. It's just like,
is there such a thing as a reverse arc where he, not reverse, but he gets to the hangar and he says, here's the reason I've been here. I can't do this.
Yeah.
So it's not like really well set up, but it is an arc because he tells us, hey, my arc started when I was afraid of flying all these years ago. I can never get this to escape with. And then he does. He flies the helicopter in this giant action scene. and it works. So he does have
he
an
does
arc.
Have it.
He just explains
really
the
short.
First.
Yeah.
He explains the first half at the moment it's gonna happen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't say that they could have set it up much better.
No,
than that.
Yeah, he's
There's
a supporting
no
character.
Yeah.
It's not as clean as the rest of them.
No,
yeah.
It's not.
Yeah, but he does have something that he needed them to come so he could get over himself and get on the helicopter or something like that. So he does have some change in his life, but I'm not sure.
He could have, at the beginning, maybe he was playing like a flying game on his PlayStation.
Yeah, on
he's like, oh, I hate this.
I'm scared.
I'm so bad at flying.
So with all this arc and theme stuff we're talking about, though, I was at the Austin Film Festival like 15 years ago, and I saw Scott Rosenberg, one of the writers here. Scott Rosenberg, he wrote like Con Air. He wrote a lot of those movies. Armageddon.
Gone in 60 Seconds.
Gone in 60 Seconds. He was really hot during that period.
So a lot of these four-hander movies then.
Yeah, that's a good
point.
They're
all team movies.
And you know, the movie he got to start with was Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead. Beautiful Girls was his movie. So that's a good point. But I remember sitting there. I used to always go check him out when I went to the Austin Film Festival. Plug for the Austin Film Festival. It's all screenwriting and conferences and stuff like that. It's a great place to hang out if you're a screenwriter. And it was him and Shane Black would do this morning conference every morning. And somebody asked him the question, do you think of theme when you write? And he said, no. He said he absolutely never thinks of theme. He didn't say he didn't think of character arc, which is kind of is tied hand in hand, depending on how you do it. But then Shane Black started to quiz him on things and point to things in the script. And he goes, yeah, well, I thought about that. And he's like, that's theme. Yeah. So a lot of people don't even approach it beforehand with the theme, or they never even get there. But instinctually,
never writing. Without reading the books and like having discussions like this, I would have never even thought to think about
inherently.
That.
Inherently.
Because I just think about characters and their arc. And
do
then,
you?
Yeah.
At some point, I do. But I'm not saying before. I don't know when. It just depends. It comes to me at some point. But at some point, I definitely do.
Put it all down, kind of the basics, and then go, this is what I'm trying to say?
Don't you think it's in the eye of the beholder type thing, too?
It. Yeah.
The audience can find a theme, too, without...
Yeah, but the storyteller has something specific, usually.
Yeah.
In mind.
I usually get to that point where I aim for something. I put, like, a target up there.
It's funny that we're talking about this through Jumanji.
Yeah. I think it's
perfect.
Yeah, no, it's very well defined in this movie, though. So
yeah, in a movie like this, you almost have to think about it in these terms because they really do want that in their movie. They want to deliver that kind of message, that family message and things like
Who
that.
Who are you?
But yeah, I will target it. I'll target it.
Yeah.
I'll target it. But then a lot of times it'll change. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I'll hide it. A lot of times,
is it definable usually by like a sentence or a question or a...
In the end, you smooth it out. Not
can it be
first.
One word like loss? Or
that's more subject matter.
Is that subject matter?
Theme.
Okay.
We talked about the moral premise. That's that, mm-hmm. you know, vice leads to physical detriment.
Yeah.
Virtue leads to positive outcome. I use that. I've used many things over time. I've done
me
things
too.
Like you've said. And that's the one that encompasses all the pieces for me. So I like to use that.
I agree.
But I'll aim and then I'll change. And then sometimes like a director will come on board and they'll want me to take it completely out or hide it, like really scrub it away. So it is the audience's interpretation. And a lot of times I'll leave it in there, but I'll hide it enough that nobody can really point to what it is or they really have to sit down.
You got
to
dig.
Yeah, and when I analyze films, not like Jumanji, this is an easy one
it's
to figure
easy.
Out because
the
say
principal
it.
Says
they
it,
say
and
it.
Then a couple other characters
but
say it.
But it's usually the hardest thing for me to analyze because sometimes I might be making up stuff.
You're finding meaning where there isn't. Yeah,
oftentimes
we do that. We just do that.
So you know, even me saying like, "Is there something in the Freakhouse?" I'm fishing for that. I don't necessarily think the writer intended to, but
I don't think I would have ever thought to question the Freakhouse aspect.
I liked just, that you questioned
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I know. I really
it's
do.
It's the type of thing I would question in my own writing.
Yeah.
So if I was writing it, I would probably say, how does that connect to this overall thing? And sometimes I'd find an answer, and sometimes I'd be like, screw it. I just like the Freakhouse. I'll keep it in.
Well, to me, I would think if I was writing it, or even just as a audience member, it's just, I just need to know Tim Matheson's his dad.
Yeah.
I just need that actor to actually come out and be like all grizzled. And then at the end, he's like, I'm a happy
he's
guy.
Happy.
And my
son's my son
alive.
Returned.
Right. Or not returned. He never experienced it.
He never experienced
it.
The
Jumanji
loss.
Resets everything.
Yeah.
So I think it's really just that. Yeah. There's no reason besides establishing there's a guy that's life is ruined, and here's what his life is not ruined at the end.
That's right.
Yeah.
Then, there's no theme there or anything other than
no.
Yeah. But I think there's
it's just before and after photo. That's really it.
That's
all it is.
But building off of what you said, as far as strategically what you do, I think there's value in both. I think there's value in like thinking hard and long about it beforehand and constructing your characters and their goals based around what the theme is that's being stated by their victories or their failures. But there's also value in just telling the story and then figuring it out after and then fine-tuning it.
I've done both.
Yeah,
and,
me too.
And a lot of writers will say that they always find the theme. They can't think of it in advance. Then some writers, it can be very helpful, like you just said, to construct your characters. You can come up with a theme and then start saying, okay, well, you know, who's this girl? Oh, she's going to be the one that's self-absorbed because that's based on the theme. Oh, who's this guy? Well, he's going to be the guy that's afraid of everything. And you can construct all your characters around the theme. Sometimes you can construct your characters around arguments of a theme. Like Shrek is always a great example, I think, of that does that.
We should talk about Shrek on this podcast at some point.
Okay, yeah. Whatever you guys want.
But
when I see that enthusiasm there.
Yeah, yeah. Shrek,
well, it's a good teaching script.
I don't like Shrek.
Ooh,
oh! I know.
It has a good... Well, that'll make it all the more...
Rossio, fun.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
It has a really well... define all its characters are based around an argument about a theme, which is kind of like self-confidence and how they relate to the world. Like you have the villain who's trying to control the world and make it in his image. You have Shrek who's rejecting the world and wants to be left alone. You have Fiona who has her own problems. Donkey seeks acceptance in other people. So they're all constructed around a theme and they all have their own ways of dealing with that problem. So they're inherently in conflict. You know, Donkey wants a friend. Shrek just wants to be left alone. That's conflict. So there can be an advantage to creating characters around that.
Based around your theme.
Yeah. Or you can just start writing. And
When I first started,
I always love the caveats you guys have. Or you can just do anything you want.
Well, we're trying to be like, you can do whatever you want. And as long as it works, it works.
There's a system in place. If you want it.
A lot of times I'll wrestle with those ideas and I'll say, screw that. I'll find it. I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Sometimes I just need to get in there and start typing. And
you got a story you're dying to tell, man.
And then look back and be like, well, what does this mean?
Exactly.
They put the jewel there, but why?
Why?
Mostly I just hate rewriting, so I like to figure out the first draft as close to my final draft as possible.
Man, I'm the opposite. I love rewriting, man, because that's where, for me, where the movie gets good.
I like rewriting. I don't like big rewrites. I don't like restructuring.
Page one.
Let's get rid of these characters, bring these
characters
in.
There's a natural weirdness to first drafts that I do enjoy.
Yeah.
Because what
it's fresh, man.
It just poured out of you, and it's like, what the hell is that? Yeah. You know,
vomit draft.
I feel like if we're gonna talk about anything left in Jumanji, I feel like the one thing we kind of didn't talk about is when they get back. Anything to say about that?
It's like a denouement. It's a good clap and take a bow. Every character has their moment to take a bow, and you clap and say, "Yay! I'm so glad that you succeeded."
Do you find it weird? Something I found odd is I don't know if it was in the script. But they don't really touch on like the weird time travel aspect of Alan. Is Alan, that was his name, right? The kid who was lost
Spencer.
In there. No.
Alex.
Alex. Mm-hmm. The weird aspect of him obviously going transported back to the night he left.
Yeah.
Untouched. They don't touch on any of that really.
Yeah.
I guess they didn't really in the first movie. For some reason in this movie, it stood out to me because they made the time issue so big in when they were in the game.
Did you find an inconsistency logic-wise? Or
I don't know. Some reason I wanted them to talk. Like, he didn't even say, like, it's been so long.
For me, the casting messed it up, and then I realized, oh, wait, he's an avatar in the game. It's not what the dude actually looked like. I was like,
I almost wish they didn't have one of the... They shouldn't have had, like, a white kid play a white guy and then turn into Colin Hanks.
Yeah,
I was
messed me up
visually. There's three white dudes playing this one character.
Yeah, exactly. That messed me up, and then I took a second and I was like, oh, that's right, the guy in the game isn't what he actually looked like.
Yeah. How did he turn into Colin Hanks? Oh, wait. Right, he's not... Yeah, right.
That's not the
script. Other than that,
though.
I found this really satisfying. But
Did you guys like the movie overall?
Oh yeah,
I did. I'm hoping that there's more movies like this because I want to write them.
Yes.
So
they're so fun. I mean, it made $900 million already worldwide. Yeah. Why not do more movies? But the argument there with the suits will probably be because it has brand awareness already.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure, but, you know, we can bring back Interspace or something.
Yes!
No, and that's like, those are generally my favorite movies of all time. Interspace is in my top five.
What
a
void. What a void for these kids. Well, I feel for my 11-year-old nephew, man.
I mean, I the one thing I would hope from this is that you can give Jake Kasdan, like, former Joe Dante stuff. You know, like, somebody's fill that hole. You know, like, I know Edgar Wright has always, he lived in there for, you know, but I don't know. Well, some of his movies, I feel like they do. But no one's really doing it on, like, a mass scale. Like, Edgar Wright's a little bit more specific. The audience for him isn't, like,
out there. It's like, who's the new Christopher Columbus?
Yes.
Who is that?
Or Joe Dante.
There's nothing out there right now.
Maybe, like, Jake Kasdan, maybe he could work
the talent's out there. It's the vehicles for that.
Find him and find them, you know? It doesn't matter who it is.
Please, Hollywood.
Make more movies like this? It's weird to say that about Jumanji.
It is weird, but yeah. Yeah.
They're gone, or they've gone to other places. Like, you know, Disney Channel might make something like it, like a low budget $1 million approximation.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. You know,
but
we're talking about
see.
Like A class Hollywood budget
they're
here.
Just not there.
Yeah,
I maybe we actually just found the reason we all have a podcast together.
Yeah,
it's because we like this type of movie that just isn't.
It's true. It's the mixture of genres, the fact that you get laughs. Thrills, you get some character arc in there, you know, it's all there. That's the cool thing about these movies. Everything is there.
Yeah.
You have it all.
And this was successful, as opposed to sometimes they've tried in the past, but this doesn't feel like it's leaning on anything, whereas, like, I actually liked the Ghostbusters reboot.
I
enjoyed it. I've watched it. The extended cut's actually way better.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah. But that didn't feel like it fills this hole.
It
doesn't feel the same. I don't, because the way it's written, the way it's written is different.
You know what's weird?
It's the improv.
And I guess
the improv kills it. Yeah.
This is the business side of it, but I guess I don't even feel like they have to make movies for this price like this.
No.
Like, they could be cheaper than
$5 million version.
Yeah. They could do some other.
Okay.
You notice how somber we're getting talking about this subject? We're so sad.
It's the death of the four quad family film.
Where's the Joe Dante movies?
Where's Back to the Future?
Yeah.
I mean, those are impossible standards. I mean, we're also living, I mean, not to bring up off mic conversations, but you say, where's Back to the Future? Back to the Future is in another movie now.
Yeah.
That they're releasing by Steven Spielberg. So it's weird to want this stuff back when it's like we're post that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's my why.
For now.
Maybe history can repeat itself with that kind of stuff in the industry.
Well, I think with this one, and I even think with Stranger Things in a weird sort of way,
mm-hmm.
it's a little different, not quite the same. But I think we might, these kid protagonist movies are another thing we really don't see. But we didn't see that many of them back then either.
That's true.
But, you know, the ones that stand out, we remember like Goonies or something. But there's not a ton of them. Lost
Boys.
Lost Boys, exactly.
So do you have hope that this could come back? This helps.
I don't think it will, but maybe it could.
There'll be one.
There'll be one.
One every 2 years, something like that.
Yeah, there'll be Jumanji 2.
Yeah, Jumanji 2 is the...
And then there'll be
please come up with a different name. Please.
We're talking about the greenlit sequel to Welcome to the Jungle as being called Jumanji 2.
I mean, I'm not even that hot on Welcome to the Jungle being the title.
No.
I wish this was actually just called Jumanji 2.
Yeah.
But the idea of calling... Jumanji 2 angers me.
Well, the kids don't know about the first one.
They probably went back and watched it. Do you think there was do you think they were disappointed when it wasn't like a laugh out loud comedy?
Oh, the kids?
Yeah.
Nah.
I don't think they care.
I
would bet the kids like it more for the adventure and the adults come for the comedy.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm still child minded enough to like be into the adventure part. Mm-hmm. You know?
The wonder. I miss the wonder.
Yeah.
Everything's cynical now. Everything.
I don't know if I'd agree with that.
The snark.
There's snark.
Everything's
but...
snarky. No one's just, this is magical. Everyone's, this is magical. Ha ha, let's make a joke about it.
Well, hopefully we'll have a Ready Player One episode. We can.
Yes, I
really
hope it's not.
Open. Well, that's, I think, without, that's what we want to talk about, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Spielberg can bring that back with all the other old stuff. Man, it's so weird.
It's a weird movie.
It's so weird.
We'll see it.
Yeah. Is there anything else you guys want to talk
no,
about Jumanji?
I think we covered it all.
I think we covered everything.
I think we covered it. We're good. Let's get out of this
game
podcast we're back. Trapped in.
Yeah, I know.
That'll
seriously.
Be the sequel.
My body!
Put that eye back.
Thanks for listening, guys.
Yeah, seriously, thank you. Go see Jumanji. It's really fun.
Yeah, it's great.
It's
on
demand.
And it's struggling to make money. And we,
yeah,
that's right.
We want more
your
movies
money.
Like this. Your
thank
ticket,
God you listened to this
your
podcast.
Tickets. All right, bye.
Bye.
You have just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.